Hi, hello. Welcome to Season 5 of The Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. We talk about money, mental health, relationships, the creative process itself, and everything in between. This season specifically focuses on creativity within the realm of environmental conservation and social public art. I'm your host, Shannon Byrne. Hannah Spencer does all of our design and branding, and Lonnie Webb runs our Instagram and makes many of our visuals. Big thanks to Jeffrey Silverstein, who was a guest on our last season, for letting us use his song, Given the Light, this season's intro music. Hope you all dig it. Yella, I am very excited to officially kick off the season. My first conversation is with Anna McLeod, who is a visual artist and independent researcher based in, I don't know how to say her town's name. It's in Western Ireland, in like the countryside. Her work mediates complex ideas associated with contemporary, historical, and cultural readings of place through a variety of methods, strategies, and processes. She employs quasi-scientific methods, interdisciplinary collaboration, performance, and socially engaged activism to critique contemporary landscapes and build metaphoric spaces for reimagining the future. I had the extreme pleasure of getting to know Anna and her work over the course of the month I spent elsewhere. She is, first of all, hilarious and so, so smart. A wealth of knowledge on all topics surrounding water, its usage, history, religious and cultural relevancy across the globe, and more. In this episode, we dig into all of that. Just so you know, for the first like 20 minutes or so, we talk very much about her career and how she became an academic, and then how she turned back to her full-time art practice, and how she got into socially engaged art, and how she wound up in Peonia with me. And then start really getting into the conversation of water and history of Ireland, and yeah, how our disconnection to water in developed countries makes us more wasteful, and a lot more. It's pretty fascinating stuff, what she's learned about water and the human psyche, and how she portrays that through her art, which is always beautiful. Definitely be sure to check out Anna's website at annamcleod.com. That's M-A-C-L-E-O-D, not McLeod. And as always, you can find links to everything that we talked to, as well as show notes at theprocess.co. Yeah, sweet. Hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you in a couple of days. Cheers, y'all.
My name's Anna McLeod, and I'm an independent researcher and visual artist based in the northwest of Ireland in a town called Manor Hamilton. Well, today I'm in Peonia, Colorado, and I'm here for a two-month residency, artist residency, called Inspired Art at Work. And we've just completed our symposium. So today was rest day. So it was a two-month residency looking at socially engaged practice within the town of Peonia. Some of the themes that were looked at were things like climate change, community building, resilience for the future, you know, resilience in the face of changing climate, and how that might affect the farmers of this region and how it might affect the economies of this region. Primarily it's a farming community, but there are, there's one coal mine left open out of a number of coal mines in the area, and this has had a big impact on the local economy. And so I think there has been an attempt by Elsewhere Studios here in Peonia, which have hosted this Inspired Art at Work project, has been an attempt to look at the different types of communities that have developed out of, you know, the end of coal, as it were, and how they might have competing interests in terms of further industrialisation of the landscape. And it's interesting for me because as a socially engaged artist, I'm interested in the themes of water and water conservation and how we use water in different ways, like domestically, industrially, and through agriculture.
And all of your work is socially driven, right?
In recent years, I've been working on this series of projects called Water Conversations for over 10 years now, and it's brought me to a lot of places around the world, and the focus has been on water. But water is a very mutable element, and of course, within that, it takes in politics, culture, social entities around water and its uses, spirituality around water, and then I suppose how land is used, how food is grown, and how societies are shaped around water. And all these things have sort of been woven into a big series of projects.
Yeah. What was the impetus for Water Conversations?
Well, my very first project, I was part of a team of artists in Leitrim, which is my county in northwest of Ireland, who were selected to work with a lead artist, Alfredo Jarre, who's a Chilean-US artist. He's quite big in the art world. Mm. And he was brought over to work with five local artists in Leitrim. And he teaches on the Whitney programme in New York. And it was like we were very lucky because we were paid to do this. And we also got a mini Whitney programme, which was fantastic. And this was at a point at which I was at a bit of a crossroads in my own practice, you know. And it was great working with Alfredo because for each of us, he just sort of forensically delved down into what we were doing as artists and sort of asked us really difficult questions. And like, he'd go away, he'd be with us for a week, and then he'd go away for a few months, and then he'd come back, and we'd been given like homework to do in the meantime, and he'd be back, and he was like a hard taskmaster. He really was. So you know, you'd really do your homework. Yeah. And if you hadn't, he'd say things like, you know, I just can't make up my mind whether you're just lazy or whether you're not a very committed artist. So things like that, and it'd be really challenging, you know. But I think he pulled the best out of us. So as a result of that, we all came up with an umbrella theme under which all five artists would do projects. And the umbrella theme was how the Celtic Tiger, this was just before the collapse of the economic collapse in 2008, so let's say it's 2006-07, and we're looking at the effects of the Celtic Tiger economy and on this huge boom and bust boom time in Ireland, and how that was affecting rural counties and how it was affecting rural towns as well. So we were looking at gentrification and how the landscape was changing hugely, and each of us took an aspect of what this unbridled building boom was doing to the rural economies in Ireland. And I did a lot of research into water and how it was affecting, like basically they were building on floodplains, and it was turning into a planning problem in that they were selling off these houses that were built, you know, really fast, and they weren't for huge amounts of money on floodplains. And of course, the next time it flooded, it might not flood for 5 years, but when it did flood, these houses were ruined, you know. So you probably heard of the term ghost estates. This is a time of in Ireland where all these houses were built, then the economic crash happened, and, you know, if they weren't already sold, these houses turned into ghost estates where there was just nothing, nobody living in them, they were worthless.
What happened in Florida at the same time.
So ghost estates come. So we, in a funny sort of way, we almost predicted the ghost estate economy because we were being critical, each of us in our own way, in our own projects. We're saying, this is so unsustainable, it's not going to work. You just can't have this kind of development in rural towns. You know, the population can't double like that overnight. And anyway, it doesn't have the infrastructure to deal with it in terms of schools and hospitals and healthcare and all those things just weren't there, you know.
Yeah.
And so I suppose each of us, from a different point of view, took a failure of planning or a failure of governmental infrastructural planning as our themes. And mine was around about how water was, not only were people building on floodplains and putting themselves in danger, or their, you know, their livelihood in danger, but also the septic tanks from these housing estates were leaching into water bodies, which provided the water for town. So a year after the project, and I did a project called Rain Catcher, which I built a system of catching the rain and turning it into potable water. But a year after I did that, the city of Galway had to close its water system for 6 months because there had been an outbreak of cryptosporidium, which turned out to be human generated. So it had been all these houses, their septic tanks were leaching through the soil into the lake, and this was the lake that fed the water system for Galway, and people started getting ill. And that's when they discovered that the water was completely, I mean, no amount of chlorine was going to like solve this one.
Yeah.
So it had to be a root and branch fix for that. So anyway, so that's what got me started on water. And it just has just, like a snowball running down the hill, it just has got bigger and bigger and bigger as I go.
Yeah. You mentioned that your career was at a crossroads.
Mm.
Why is that? Or in what way?
Well, I was a lecturer of fine art in Dublin Institute of Technology. I was one of the, not a very big team, staff team, but, you know, I was a senior lecturer, and also I ran the programme. We also had a small gallery in the college, so we programmed events and exhibitions and residencies. And all this was impacting on my practice insofar as I wasn't getting enough done. You know, I didn't feel I was getting enough done. I'd sort of lost focus of my own practice within the demands of academia. I wanted to re-establish or reboot my own practice in some way, but I was a bit lost, didn't know how to do it. And this was the impetus that got me going again, and also gave me the confidence to leave teaching and become a you know, full-time professional artist. I mean, I'd been running two careers. I had a lecturing career and a full-time professional artist career as well, but, you know, you get burnt out,
yeah.
You know, and I had to get to the point where I had maybe enough confidence just to walk away from the teaching and say, right, I can be a full-time artist and I can survive financially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just about.
Yeah. What, when you were, you went to school for art, yeah?
Yes, I did, yeah. Yeah.
What was your focus?
When I went to college first, we did a very generalist, it used to be a diploma. In Ireland, before degrees came in, it was a four-year diploma.
Yeah.
And then it changed to a degree. And then the MA. So they all sort of rolled out over the years. So when I started, it was a generalist course, and you just did all aspects of fine art, so painting, sculpture, even graphic work, filmmaking, photography, etc. And then I gravitated towards sculpture.
Okay.
So I, you know, I finished as a sculpture major. But I also did painting. I had a career as a painter for a while as well. You know, so, you know, multidisciplinary is what we used to call it. It's now called interdisciplinary more within the arts, within the fine art or visual art world. Interdisciplinary insofar as you can migrate across different disciplines within the fine art lexicon.
Yeah. At that point, were you like, I'm going to be a full-time artist, or did you know that you were going to have to teach for a while?
Well, I graduated in the 80s. And it was recession time.
Mm-hmm.
There were no jobs. I mean, really, you know, it was nearly impossible to be an artist.
Yeah.
So most people who were artists just did it, not as professionals, but as, you know, something you did while, you know, you washed dishes to do it, or I worked in restaurants. I, you know, did whatever I could to earn money to be an artist. But there was very little money, especially in Ireland in those days. There were some galleries, but there was no real commercial opportunities really for artists. There wasn't a big buying market, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I managed to muddle along. But then I was very lucky. A teaching post came up part-time in what was then, before it became Dublin Institute of Technology. It was City of Dublin VEC. And I got a part-time job. And it went on from there. I was part-time for many, many years, which was an unstable, you never really were quite sure whether you're going to be re-employed in September again, you know, so you spent the summer going, biting your nails, going, am I going to be employed or not? And then eventually the European Union said to the Irish government, you can't keep doing that to people. It's, you know, you have to give people contracts. You cannot just, you know, treat staff like that. So if you employ anybody for over 3 years consecutively, you must give them a contract,
yeah,
which was great. You know, a bit of social legislation from the EU. And so then I became a full-time lecturer, which was great.
How many years were you a lecturer before you
gave up?
Crossroads came up, yeah. I wouldn't say you gave up. You just transitioned.
I just walked away. Yeah. Well, I walked away from teaching. I was 29 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a long time.
It was a long time. But 15 or maybe more maybe 17 of those years were as a part-time year-by-year contract, you know, one-year contract. It was very insecure. Yeah. But I did have that luxury of the other years being, you know, secure, the security of tenure, you know, which was great.
Yeah.
You know.
So has your work always had like a political, for lack of a better term, or research-based component? Or have you ever just like produced, made flowers?
Yeah. I think, no, I think when I think back at my very early work, even in college, I had a very keen interest in politics. So I was president of the Students' Union in the college I was in. Yeah, we were out marching. It was a time of a lot of marches and a lot of protest for better conditions. Ireland was, you know, there was a lot of inequalities in Ireland in the 80s. There was also a war.
Yeah.
And, you know, students in those days were very highly politicised. I mean, we had the war, we had the situation going on in Northern Ireland. People were very active politically on one side or another.
Mm.
You know, there was a lot of socialism. I don't know whether you've ever heard of it, but there was a lot of students were out boycotting all the time, boycotting shops that sold South African goods. There was a lot of anti-apartheid activity in Ireland at the time. And I think people saw it as in the greater realm of injustice. There was injustice of the British treating a nation in Northern Ireland, internment without trial, you know. The treatment of Irish people in England at the time was appalling. So we were quite highly politicised anyway, and then we saw ourselves in a greater struggle, global struggle, you know. So we had a huge amount of solidarity with people that, like, say, under apartheid regimes.
Yeah.
You know? So it was just, it was in the air. It was a very politically active time in the country, and therefore it was hard for me to be an artist and separate myself from that. So my work was quite political, always.
But you had a interesting and different for the time family fabric too. Did that also inform your art?
I think, yeah, very much so. I was very aware of racial politics because I had a stepfather who was black and a white mother. So I'm white. So my stepfather was black. So it was unusual in Ireland to have any people of colour. It was quite a monocultural country at the time. The only people from other ethnic backgrounds that were around really were doctors or medical students in Dublin. But you certainly wouldn't see anyone of any other ethnic identity outside of Dublin.
Mm.
You know, very, very white. I'm a very Irish. You might find the odd European, but not many. So Ireland was quite insular at the time, and certainly quite monocultural. It's only in the 1990s on that we saw more and more ethnic minorities coming into the country, you know.
Why is that? I feel like that's a dumb question, but whatever, I'm uneducated.
Well, I think a number of things. As members of the European Union, we had to have free trade of workers across Europe. So anyone from anywhere in Europe can come and work in Ireland or vice versa.
Mm.
And that brought in people from all over who would be maybe French citizens, but from African countries. Or, you know, so, you know, there'd be workforces coming in. Also, we relaxed international laws in terms of workforces coming in for, like, you'll find in Ireland a very high portion of nursing staff and doctors from Southeast Asia, for example, you know, and that started to happen then. And also, as part of our EU responsibilities, was to take in asylum seekers and refugees from other countries. So Ireland, along with any other European Union country, takes in a quota. And it was a very welcome to see this broadening of cultural identity within Ireland. And you now have people referred to as Black Irish, but they're, you know, the Irish citizens who are from other ethnic origin, you know. A lot of Africans, you know, Nigerians in Ireland now. And, you know, it's really made for a much more interesting country, has to be said,
for sure.
You know. It's brilliant, yeah.
So was it... So it was regulation preventing the diversity before the 90s?
Well, when Ireland got independence in 1923 from Britain, you know, the country was partitioned. The government of the time under President De Valera was quite, let's say, repressive regime. Some say it was proto-fascist, very heavily influenced by the Catholic Church. So it was a very repressive regime. It was quite isolationist insofar as we didn't like anyone of any other ethnic origin or religious minorities weren't tolerated, really. Ireland stayed neutral in the Second World War, but weren't very keen on any refugees coming in, took very few refugees from the war. All that changed after we joined the EU, to be honest, because suddenly there was an opening up of the country. One of the benefits of being in the EU is, you know, we had to change a lot of our social legislation. Like, women were allowed work inside marriage, whereas before 1970s, women, once they got married, had to leave whatever job they were in. If they were in a government job, they had to leave it. They had to leave teaching, so women teachers, you know, if they were married, didn't exist, and doctors, whatever. So any work for the government meant that you had to leave. It was called the marriage bar. Mm. There wasn't great protections for women up until the EU started saying, well, listen, you have to have some social legislation. It can't be legal to beat up women within the marriage or rape them or whatever it is, you know. Yeah. So protections for women started to come in. You know, we didn't have it. We've only just recently had abortion legislation. There was no abortion until this year.
Wow.
Marriage equality came in a couple of years ago. We didn't have any gays in Ireland until, you know, apparently until television.
Well,
apparently
they were there.
They were hiding. But officially, you know, it didn't exist. You know, right. And it was very discriminated against. And the old laws were still on the statute books. It was illegal to be anything other than heterosexual. So it was very repressive. I think it was 1995. It was legalized.
Wow.
Very late in the day. So a lot of repression, a lot of Catholic Church repression. Social repression. But at the end of the 70s and early 80s, my generation started rebelling against that. It took a long time for it to actually become law, these things. But this is when, you know, people started rebelling and going, no, we're not having this. Our parents might have put up with that kind of repression, but we're not putting up with it. Yeah. You know, and there had been some brave people in the 60s as well who started, you know, social movements, but they really came into flowering in the 70s and 80s.
Do any stories come to mind easily of art's role during that time?
Yeah, well, I was part of a group of artists, and we used to put on an annual exhibition and raise money to support artists. It was called Independent Artists. And we'd have a big annual exhibition, we'd give out awards and things like that and try and help struggling artists, you know. Mm. So for a number of years we had shows that were themed around anti-repression, so we'd choose a theme, and there was a lot of street art as well. Like, we bought billboards and, you know, had competitions where artists' work would, you know, be selected and then put up on billboards. And yeah, so it was quite politically engaged in terms of looking at the social problems in the world. But apartheid was a big one at that time, because it really was at a head in South Africa. The Palestinian struggle, there's still a very strong relationship between artists in Ireland and you know, I include actors as well in that, in terms of support for Palestinian people. You know, I think Irish people tend to feel very strongly for the underdog. Yeah. Particularly when they feel that they're being brutalized by colonial overlords,
because they were
because we identify with that.
Yeah,
having you know, only got independence from a British colony in 23.
Right.
So it's not very long. No. It's not even 100 years.
Yeah.
And then of course with what was going on in Northern Ireland, there was still a lot of anti-Irish sentiment in England. It was a difficult time. It was hard to get jobs. The Irish community were quite ghettoised, I would say, you know, along with other ethnic groups, but they tended to be ghettoised in England.
Yeah.
That's changed now. It has changed. And I mean, Britain has formally said sorry about Northern Ireland and some of the atrocities that they committed against, you know, Catholic population, internment and things like that.
Mm.
But, you know, it's still tense. Memories are long, and there's been unresolved issues as well.
Yeah.
As there always are after wars.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So, in what ways have you watched art and the art scene in Ireland evolve?
Yeah, it's got very vibrant. I mean, it's really, I have to say that the Arts Council of Ireland are extremely supportive.
Mm-hmm.
and they do an extremely good job in supporting artists and arts institutions. And I would say we're very well serviced. And now there have been cuts, particularly since 2008. There's been nasty cuts, but you know we've good education, visual arts education, a lot of universities, and then we have you know pretty good county council support for artists. And not saying it couldn't be better, but it's not bad.
Yeah.
And like in the United States here, you know, there's more philanthropy. We don't really have the, well, we do have plenty of rich people, but they don't give to the arts for sure.
Mm.
So we don't really have a culture of that. So unless you have state support or European support, it's quite difficult. And
yeah.
We don't have a huge art market. There's a small one, but it's not like the United States. It's not as rich as that. It's been wonderful, really, for artists and actors and, you know, all aspects of the arts, writers.
Does it feel like an artist has to be almost like an international artist to be successful in Ireland still?
Yeah, it is a bit, you know, unfortunately, yeah, you know. And it's still a bit, maybe, it seems to be getting better, but there used to be a sort of inferiority complex. Unless you made it outside of Ireland, you weren't going to make it in Ireland either, you know, and
right.
Once you had exhibitions outside of Ireland, then you sort of got an extra stamp of legitimacy or something. But that's changed now. And so there's many different types of art. You've got people who are more interested in community socially engaged type of practice, then you've got your standard, you know, museum artists, you've got your, not everyone's political, obviously, you know, but it's just I am more drawn to the people or to the group that I would hang around with are more socially engaged type of artists who are taking on big subject matter like climate change or social inequalities or war or cultural identity issues,
yeah.
And so on, you know.
So let's go back to water conversations.
Yes.
We don't have to walk through every project.
No.
But what have been some of the big moments for you within that project, and what type of impact have they had on you and on the community and what you were engaging with?
Well, my early projects for Water Conversations brought me to Ghana, West Africa. That was quite soon after I did the first project in Ireland, and then India. Now, these had profound effects on me because I had been in India before, but I hadn't been focusing on water. I learnt so much about how water is viewed in other parts of the world in terms of ethnically and socially. Like, if you go to India, you'll find most people have come from the country, like they're one generation, a bit like Ireland, but they're one generation from the country,
mm-hmm.
moved to the city. Same in Africa, in Ghana and West Africa, I found the same. So they had a very deep knowledge of taboos and practices around water, sacred practices around water, cultural taboos around, you know, never mix milk with water. You know, never wash milky things in water because it kills the fish. And, you know, that sort of knowledge, you know, keeping your toilet and where you wash and all those far away from the drinking sources and all the rest of it downstream, etc. And all that sort of, I learned so much from people telling me stories from their villages and from their towns about the difficulties of water, the different economics around it. And I found that really fascinating. And I got much of, I started to, and then I went to Australia as well. And I started to get a sort of global picture of how difficult water provision is. You don't have to tell these people in developing countries how to conserve water because they are the most economical around water that I've ever met. I also learned a lot about rainwater harvesting, grey water reuse, just non-technical, but just watching how people used water in very economical ways. And that impressed upon me the urgency for that, because we're terribly wasteful with water in developed countries. It's like as if there's an endless supply. We just don't have that connection maybe to it, or because we turn on a tap, it just comes out. Yeah, we don't even think about it. We don't walk with it. We don't carry it on our heads, and therefore we're terribly wasteful. That education gave me a big focus for water on how could I contribute to the debate of water conservation, and also how could I contribute to reminding people the visceral relationship they have with water, particularly in developed countries. I don't need to remind people in developing countries.
Yeah.
But here, it's sort of like people go, yes, water is very important. Yes, yes, yes. You know, like, but it's sort of not really sinking in.
Mm-hmm.
And the day the tap doesn't work or your plumbing goes off, you know, that is a bit of a crisis and people don't know what to do. So I kind of, the water conversations for me now have been looking at water sort of in practical ways, but also looking at the emotional connection we have with it and how that needs to be maybe nurtured as we face into water shortages potentially due to climate change.
How have you communicated that or elicited a response around water people in developing countries?
Yeah, well, I've in the last few projects I've done in Australia, Mongolia, Canada, and here in the United States, I've looked at industrialization of water, industrial uses of water, and contamination. So the leaching into water bodies from tailings piles from mining industry, and then also other types of contamination, like, for example, uranium and plutonium. Some of these contaminations are so serious, they threaten whole aquifers. And I suppose that disconnect. So I've been trying to highlight these dangers the fossil fuel industry poses to water. And like, I think a lot of people know this already deep down, but sometimes it needs to be pointed out.
Oh, for sure.
People forget. Or,
like you said, it's like the faucet thing.
Yeah, or it's inconvenient.
People just turn on their light.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not thinking about where that power is coming from.
It's true. So power and water, they have this very deep relationship, especially in Canada. You look at Alberta tar sands and like what's happening to the water bodies around there as a result of that. I mean, it's massive scale. Extractive processes. It's having an effect on the climate. It's so big it's having an effect on the climate in North America. And that in turn is having an effect on snowpack. And, you know, we have to remember, what is the source of water? Where does it come from?
Yeah.
It doesn't just fall from the sky. You know, it's evaporation. So the hydrological cycle is a very important one, and it's becoming interrupted by climate change. And this goes right down deep to the very fundamentals of our existence. And I've been trying to, in gentle ways, remind people of that relationship and what can they do, you know, or encourage them to emotionally deal with that, but also practically, you know, how can we contribute to consuming less? And the consumption involves fossil fuels, it also involves water. So how can we consume less and protect what we have left of water sources?
Can you share some more details about some of the projects and how you communicate these subtle ways, like the art itself, in what way?
Because I'm traveling a lot, and I also want to use very few materials as much as possible. I try to use recycled materials, but I've developed a strategy of making banners which get carried through places, either by myself or other people, to elicit conversations around. And the banner might say something like, "Harvest the rain," which is what the banner I made for Peonia here, because rainwater harvesting doesn't take place, and it should,
yeah.
In this town.
I love that you gave the banner to the high school.
And I hope that
young.
It'll start young. I hope it'll be an educational tool as well to have those kind of conversations. I make portable sculptures that I carry on community walks or sometimes lone walks, where the walk might be documented through photography or video, or both. And sometimes community walk with me. And again, it's an opportunity to just discuss water at whatever fundamental level people want to discuss it at. You know, whether it's there's been a drought in this part of the world, in Peonia this summer. It's been very hot. And because there was less snow last year, snowpack was down. It was only a couple of inches. So the water has been quite scarce this year. I think it's made people worry slightly. It's just ever so slightly people are beginning to get a little bit worried about the water. It's not really impacted yet. It's not a drought as such, mm-hmm. not yet. But I think it's a timely period to start thinking about, well, how best can we conserve the water we have? If this continues, if there's less snowpack year after year, what does that mean for Colorado? What does it mean for this valley? What does it mean for the agriculture in this valley, which they're pinning their hopes on as the new economy?
From coal to agriculture,
yeah, but will there be enough water for the agriculture?
Right.
And what ways can people approach, can communities get together and build water resilience, climate resilience into their water practices? I mean, currently there's a lot of crops grown in this valley I personally think are probably not the best for water conservation, you know, like hops is a very water thirsty crop.
Yeah.
And they're growing hops here for the beer industry, yeah. And I'm wondering, is that really sustainable into the future? If these drought conditions continue, marijuana is grown quite a lot in this valley as well.
Such a thirsty plant.
And that's a very thirsty plant. Is that sustainable? Probably not.
Yeah.
So they're obviously going to have to start thinking more about drought-resistant seeds and crops, varieties, you know, for the different things. So, yeah, I hope that some of the ideas that I've put into the public realm here through the banner and through the proposed murals is that some sort of debate around grey water reuse. I have designed a mural for the town, which I hope will get done after I've gone, which looks at grey water recycling and then also rainwater harvesting, because there is a law for the last 2 years in Colorado that you can rainwater harvest. It was previously illegal to do so, but for the last 2 years it's been legal and not very many people do it yet. I'd like to encourage through the murals, the two murals for the town, that people start thinking seriously about rainwater harvesting. It's amazing. Like, if you have 1 inch of rain on a roof that's 1,000 feet in surface area,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can save 630 gallons
yeah.
of water in 1 inch of rain.
Yeah.
Like, it's extraordinary, you know,
yeah.
how much you can actually collect from your roof into your garden or into, you know.
Eric Darby up on Picton Mesa, he's off the grid completely.
Yeah.
Harvests rain, and that's what he was saying. It's like a half hour rain brought their tank from 50% to 75%
full. Yeah, so it's extraordinary. And I think if you're harvesting your own rainwater,
mm-hmm.
you will find that you're more economical with it.
I
have friends in Ireland who are off the grid who and it rains a lot in Ireland, but they do sometimes have droughts and or it doesn't rain for a period. And, you know, they're very economical with the use of their water
mm-hmm.
as a result of, you know, they've only got one tank and that, well, it's a big tank, but there's five people in the household and, you know, they've got to be economical about how they use water. And I think once you're actually actively engaging with that practice, you start just turning off taps much sooner and not leaving them run and
yeah.
while you're brushing your teeth, for example. Tiny things, but it's amazing how much water can just wash away
mm-hmm.
without even... And that's treated water that was expensive to treat.
Yeah.
And you're paying for it.
Right.
So there's an economy to it as well in
yeah.
terms of, you know, you're literally pouring dollars down the sink. Anyways, and so with the portable sculptures, the intention of that work on the walks is more emotional. I've discovered in myself, and I think with a lot of conversations I've had with people, is that climate change it's deeply disturbing on many levels. You know, intellectually it's disturbing.
Yeah.
It's emotionally disturbing. And it also makes you want to nearly cry because you just don't know. You know, it's overwhelming sometimes, and I think that my performance walks are really about contemplating your own fictions around fossil fuel consumption, you know. And I know I'm an end user of mining, and I'm a net contributor
mm-hmm.
to all the water contamination that goes on in the world as well. And so it's something that I'm conscious of and I want to talk about more, and I want to grieve a little bit.
Mm.
But I also want to work on trying to mitigate some of that. I try not to buy too much stuff. I have stopped consuming. I divest a lot.
Yeah.
I'm getting rid of stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't like buying things online. And I don't, you know, I really try. Obviously, I do take air flights, and that is a worry.
Yeah.
But I plant a tree for every, I plant a hardwood for every flight I take. That's my
really?
Own little, yes, I do, yeah. It's my own little give back.
I should do that.
Well,
great
it's...
idea.
It helps. I mean, and I try not to take too many flights. I really do.
Mm.
But at the same time, it is part of my practice is to travel and spread the word, as it were.
Yeah.
And work with communities in trying to raise awareness. In the practice of the artwork itself, I try and, you know, recycle materials as much as possible. Try and make artworks that aren't going to litter up the place. It's not using too much stuff. And if it is using stuff, it's recycling.
Your walks are very powerful. And they're like... Speak to the grieving thing. You're the one here. At least you're wearing black veil.
Mm-hmm.
What you're carrying the ice.
Yeah.
Do you also carry the water here, or is that somewhere else?
Well, I've only done two with veils, and one was last year in Santa Fe. I did a water rights residency in Santa Fe Art Institute, and myself and another artist, Courtney Leonard, who's a Santa Fe artist, we did a walk on Cochiti Dam, which is in the Cochiti Pueblo near Santa Fe. And what we did was we carried water from the dam and released it at the release site where the Rio Grande comes out through the dam wall. It was in recognition of the pain and suffering that the Cochiti people, the Pueblo, have had to suffer with this dam. The dam was built in 1975 against the wishes of the Pueblo, across their most sacred mountain and across their burial grounds of their elders. Mm. There didn't seem to be any real reason for building the dam. It wasn't a floodplain, it wasn't a problem with flooding, but it is downstream, downriver, from Los Alamos, which is where the atomic bombs were produced, mm. and there's still a lot of research, national laboratory research, mm-hmm. and there is a lot of waste plutonium sediment washing down from Los Alamos into the Rio Grande, and so many people felt that the building of this dam was to somehow stop some of the silt washing further on downstream, and also it was built as a recreational lake.
Mm.
So it's known by nuclear disarmament activists like Nuke Watch, it's known as Plutonium Lake.
Yeah.
The Pueblo were very unhappy about the fact that it's there at all.
Yeah.
And so our walk, with wearing veils which were embroidered with the hydrological cycle, we carried the water in these earthen pots that Courtney made. So we walked 5 miles in the midday sun to highlight the confinement of the water, the injustice of the dam itself, the industrial pollution of the waters as well,
yeah.
from armament building, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a number of factors within that. And so the veil was appropriate. It's also sort of almost alludes to Victorian veils that were worn, big long black veils that were worn in Victorian periods. So we're sort of tangentially linking it to Industrial Revolution and the very start of this dreadful carbon footprint we now have produced.
Yeah.
And that has led to climate change. So the walk here in Paonia, I made a second veil, and this veil was embroidered with white to represent the retreating glaciers in Colorado, and you know, in North America in general, but in Colorado the glaciers are melting quite fast as the climate warms up, and I carried a 10-pound block of ice as a meditative burden, I suppose. The ice was a burden, it was heavy, I carried it for 2 hours. It melted quite slowly, but it melted. I walked down the centre of the road, and I think it started a lot of conversations. I think people were kind of shocked a little bit at first. I wasn't trying to shock people, but it was a bit of a spectacle, I suppose. But at the same time, I was just trying to like make the link between the heat, this extraordinary hot summer,
mm-hmm.
the loss of the snowpack. I'm walking on the road and I'm being surrounded by cars revving their engines, and I'm thinking, you know, we need to start making the connection,
yeah.
between our use of fossil fuels, our burning of it, our driving around with it, driving to the shops, and the disappearing waters.
Yeah.
And that it was, you know, I was just attempting to make a subtle relationship.
What's typically the emotional reaction that you hear from people, whether during or after, if you know, mm-hmm. you get the chance to engage with them during these demonstrations, for lack of a better term?
Well, to go back to the Kochiti Dam, a number of people walked with Courtney and I
mm-hmm.
on that walk. It sparked a lot of conversations about the whole American way of life, I think.
Yeah.
The post-war boom, the Dust Bowl, why Los Alamos, you know, the secrecy of the nuclear armaments production, testing in New Mexico, and how the New Mexico waters really is very badly contaminated in general with plutonium from the test sites, the testing, the bomb testing, the uranium mining, and then the production of plutonium. So that it sparked a lot of conversations about that. It also sparked conversations. We walked in flip-flops. We carried heavy water. We were exhausted by it. It was very hard work. And a lot of people started talking about women having to carry water around the world.
Yeah.
It's generally women that carry it, women
mm.
and children, and how heavy it is.
Yeah.
It's actually extremely heavy.
Mm.
Now, a cubic meter of water is a ton. You know,
yeah.
it's extremely heavy,
yeah.
and difficult to walk with because it moves.
Mm-hmm.
So as you move, it pulls you. It's sort of, you've got to get into rhythm.
Yeah, how do you do that in flip-flops? And was flip-flops the part of the showing the burden?
Flip-flops was just, you know, this is what most people around the world wear.
Yeah.
You know, poor
mm-hmm.
people.
Right.
And it's what they wear, and they carry water with flip-flops on. So you know, we wanted to get, I suppose, as authentic an experience as possible in solidarity with those people who do that on a daily basis. And it's very hard to get the rhythm. You have to work into the rhythm, mm-hmm. yeah, of walking, and to walk with the water sloshing, you know, yeah. like moving. It takes a while. That piece started a lot of conversations about the American way of life and what was wrong with America. I mean, you know, it wasn't really supposed to, but it mutated into people talking about Walmart and like shopping and the shopping culture and consumerism. And water is so mutable and such a wonderful element that it can actually spark those kind of conversations because it's all related, isn't it? And, you know, consumption, the production of the stuff that we buy uses a lot of water. Mm-hmm. Factories use water all the time. So water is like sort of the hidden element in a lot of the production of these things, right. you know. And that's, you know, so it became a circular. Here in Peonia, I have come across a lot of people who don't believe in climate change.
Who deny it. Not just don't believe in it, they deny it. I don't know if that's...
Well, they'll get a funny... But... Yeah, I mean, no, there's out and out deniers.
Yeah.
And then there's the people who go, yeah, but yeah, it's more a cycle. It's not really climate change. It's just a cycle, which is a denial.
I know I've heard extremely educated people who believe in science,
yeah,
or who subscribe to science say that.
Yeah.
That's just a cycle and that we've been through this before and it will
yeah.
regulate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that argument too. And I'm surprised that well-educated people are saying that, you
yeah.
know, because it's definitely a psychological inability, and some of my walks are trying to pierce that psychological disavowal, which is psychoanalysts talk a lot about psychological disavowal, and it means you know it's real,
yeah.
you know something's real, but you just can't quite take it in,
mm.
you can't really deal with it because it's so enormous.
Mm.
So, for example, in terms of climate change, you might go to Al Gore's film and see it, and it's, you know, it's, and you know it's true, but then you go outside and the sky's still blue and the trees are waving away and there's water in the ditches and you think, oh, it's not really that bad. So it's a denial
mm-hmm.
that it's actually happening.
And it's a short-sighted, you're looking at what's around you and not at the
yeah,
bigger picture.
Of exactly, because in some way maybe you're protecting yourself. So
mm-hmm.
psychological disavowal is a way of protecting yourself a little bit as well from the horror of what's really sort of unfolding. But it also absolves you from taking any action.
Yeah.
And that's a double-edged sword, isn't it, you know?
Right.
So you can go la-la-la-la-la-la-la-land for so long, but then a crisis will happen, and are you prepared for it?
Right.
So I've been hoping that maybe by talking about these things that, and emotionally, sort of showing an emotional engagement with the loss of ice and snow, the solid state of water, and how that will impact into the future. Like, by even starting that conversation, I'm hoping that people will... it will pierce through this sort of denial that's going on. Because people keep saying to me, a lot of people have said to me, God will fix it.
Okay.
Or, that's on the far sort of conservative side, and
yeah.
then on the very liberal side, Gaia will fix it. So both begin with G, but I'm not sure whether Gaia or God is going to help us out of our human folly.
Yeah. What... Do you say anything when you're having these conversations and people say things like this? Like, how do you respond to that?
Well, what I say is, I try. I don't argue with people because I don't think it's helpful in environmental questions at all to argue with people. So basically what I say is, but isn't it good to be prepared?
Mm.
I think most people agree. Most people don't fight against the idea of preparation, like stocking up the cupboard. You know,
weird to me or funny to me because they're saying God or Gaia will take care of them.
Yeah.
Well, then why do you need to prepare? Like, obviously, you know that God or Gaia isn't going to literally put canned
yeah.
food on your shelves.
Yeah.
But why do you even, like, if you really think that's true, then
mm.
why put the canned food there?
Well, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. But I think there's people, particularly people in rural areas, they're kind of quite pragmatic. And they come from a kind of pioneer stock where you stock up the larder for the winter or for the lean times or whatever. And there's a sort of... So on the one level, if you don't believe in climate change or you deny it completely, fine. But they're pragmatic around, you know, preparation
mm.
for minor disasters. So they're prepared to accept that there might be like swings and roundabouts. You can take that on board, but they don't see how that affects their consumption because God will fix that. So I can continue on living the same lifestyle I have right now. So what I try to do within that is to point, I say, well, personally, I think I need to make some changes, you know, because some of these industries or some of the stuff we buy is very water heavy. So I try to just gently bring in the conversation around that. And then generally people will go, yeah, you're right. You know, maybe we should be a bit more economical about water. Or a lot of people say to me, they turn off the tap and they are a bit more aware of water than they used to be. I haven't been here long enough to drill down into the deeper conversations. I would like to be here longer, and I would have liked to have more conversations with, say, organic farmers, because while they might be friends of the environment, they don't seem willing to talk about water conservation. They kind of go, well, I've got water rights and I have a certain amount of water, and you're kind of going, yeah, well, you know.
The liberal ones will talk to you about it. Or at least some of them
will. Yeah. But some of them tend to think Gaia will just fix it all, and they don't need to really change maybe crop rotation, or they don't need to think of different ways of irrigation. They're using drip tape, which is quite a wasteful, you know, spouting water up into the air like that is a wasteful way of doing it.
What is it? This is a side tangent. I've been meaning to ask people in general, like I have a lot of friends who use drip tape in their gardens, like on a very small scale. What's the other, it's an alternative to using drip tape? Other than like without going into full permaculture stuff, just watering?
Watering, yeah. I mean, you know,
getting out there and using your hose.
Yes, exactly. It's sort of like the lazy man's way of watering your garden, isn't it? You know, the other way is, see, if we're talking about gardening. You know, like, how do I design my garden to maximize the amount of water that goes out there? You know, if I'm putting grey water out there from my house, what planting plan do I have? Do I put swales into the centre of the garden because that maximizes the use of the water? It sinks the water deep into the soil so the plants can actually access the roots of the plants, and that's a much more economical way than transposing it into the air and letting it evaporate. You know, like, there's an awful lot of evaporation around here, I notice, you know, because all that drip tape in people's gardens, and this, you know, they've got spouts or whatever you call them, you know, where the water spins around. I don't know what they're called.
Sprinklers.
And I mean, that just evaporates.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a good way of doing it, and it's just going onto a flat surface. It evaporates off, or it runs off. So it's not a very economical way of using the water. But then if you combine swales and good planting, shade. Swales are where you dig a depression. So you build in ridges, mini trenches, and you fill them with rotted down bark or, you know, mulch material. And so you either put your water off your roof straight into that, and that sinks down deep into the soil, so it's not going to evaporate out, and then the plants can access that water. So you plant on the ridges around your swales, so you put a number of swales, and also you landscape your garden so that the slopes, so they slope down into the swales, and then you can like plant in around that. So that's maximizing any rainfall, and then you can get your grey water straight into it, and or you can also get your rainwater.
For listeners, grey water is water that comes from our sinks and our tubs and stuff like that, and it's filtered through.
Yes, grey water is your washing machine water, not your kitchen sink water.
Okay,
that's black water. But grey water is your bath water, your shower water, and your washing machine water.
Okay,
that's really not that dirty, unless you're incredibly filthy before you get into the bath. It's probably only soil on you anyway, you know.
What about the soaps, though?
Yeah, well, you do have to be mindful of not using detergents, you know, in your washing machine, so non-bio soaps. I heard.
Same with washing your, I guess everything you wash your body with should be bio.
Well, presumably you're not scrubbing yourself down with bleach, but yeah.
You're cleaning your tub.
Yeah, well, nobody should clean their tub with. I mean.
People do.
I know. Well, it certainly means being more mindful of those kind of things. If you're going to reuse your grey water out in the garden, you've got to think, like, if I'm going to be eating these plants, you know, what am I putting into them, you know? So if you're anyway against pesticides or anything like that, you should be against putting bleach onto your garden as well. So, or nasty corrosive materials.
So let's say someone, like, has money and isn't particularly handy, like, they couldn't figure out how to make that work themselves. That's something you can, like, hire people?
Yeah, you can. It's actually, you can DIY it yourself. And
is
you can.
Easy?
It's pretty easy. I mean, it's as easy as, you know, putting a hose out from, you know, your outlet into your your bath. Putting a hose out the window. I mean, that's as easy as, you know, that's as simple as it gets. From your washing machine, you can get a three-way lever. You're just plumbing. It's a small plumbing job. Mm. So you could probably do it all for about $100. Now, you can get very expensive systems as well.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Fancy. If you're doing a new build, you can put in a new system and you can get a company to do that. If you are, if you're doing it yourself, you can do a very simple system. Depends on what level of sophistication or how much money you have. You're going to save your utilities bill in the long run anyway.
Yeah.
You know, and water, if water gets scarcer, it's going to get more expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
So if you start now, you're going to save money anyway.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's true. That is, the money argument is always one that tends to work. Like, I have lots of friends who conserve because they're frugal.
Yeah.
They also care about the environment, but
yeah,
more because they're frugal.
Yes, exactly. And I do agree. I think, you know, they go hand in hand. I certainly, it was obviously care for the environment, but I got much more frugal with electricity at home as a result of needing to save money.
Yeah.
You know, and it hasn't really impacted on my life at all.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, you know, I just had to switch out the light bulbs and, you know, but like all my, I've got, you know, electricity saving devices everywhere, you know, so I've saved a fortune. Absolute fortune. And it's the same with water. Like, we aren't charged for water in Ireland yet, although the day is coming. Currently, we're not. But I'm still very economical with water anyway, because I just trained myself to be so.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's
gonna,
a global problem.
It
so.
Is a global problem. We're going to... Well, I mean, we're incredibly water-rich in Ireland, and it is treated water, and, you know, the water that comes out of your tap has been treated. It's expensive. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's gone through systems.
What is your process for, like, researching all this stuff and getting your information from sources you know you can trust, as well as
yeah,
I don't know, just building this library of knowledge?
Yeah, well, it just takes time, and, you know, once you are very focused on one subject, I read a lot of books around water, and I've been looking at, like, say, water from an anthropologist point of view. So there's a lot of writing in anthropology about water, so how humans have adapted to water and how they've traditionally treated water and how they've, you know, what's been the symbiotic relationship with water and land and all the rest of it. But anthropologists have a very interesting take on water. So I've read broadly that, and then geography. And then I've been looking at holy wells in Ireland. So I've been looking at faith systems and belief systems around water, which cut deep into the kind of human psyche. Water is used in every culture around the world as a ceremonial tool. I haven't come across one.
Yeah.
Where water isn't used in some symbolic way, baptism type, you know, coming of age rituals,
all the, like,
prayer,
stuff,
yeah,
uses
all, everywhere
water.
You go,
yeah,
water is sacred,
mm-hmm,
and therefore that's an area I've researched for a long time. And just talking to people in different countries, and you know, I often ask them to tell me stories that they grew up with, or I've looked at how water is culturally used in language. You know, so in the Sahara Desert, I gathered sayings, you know, Moroccan sayings that related to water, like in terms of things like somebody would say, you know, the well and its cover. And that means, you know, if somebody's talking about a problem they're having, and you don't need to go into all the details about it because you know the well and its cover, you know. So water is used sort of as an emotional tool to kind of discuss human emotions,
yeah,
you know, in language.
Talk about the flows of things.
The flows of things, the seepage of things, the,
yeah,
you know, so if you, when you start looking at language and how, and in different languages, there's very poetic words for water and rain and puddles and, you know, other than English. English can be quite boring.
Yeah.
But there's so many words associated that are onomatopoeic with water, splash and splish, and, you know, these things. And so anyway, so once you just get delved into a subject, it just gets deeper and deeper, and you get find more and more writings about it. So I've read a lot of climate change scientists about the ice caps. I've read a lot of scientists, books on physics about water. And, you know, just to give you, because when you're deeply interested in something, you do retain the information. I can't say I'm brilliant at retaining information on something that I'm kind of vaguely interested in. You know, it's only when I'm really embedded,
yeah,
that I retain it. And then I forget a lot as well. You know, I have to reread the books.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my luxuries is I do have a lot of books.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one thing I can't seem to divest from. I keep buying books.
Yeah.
But I try and buy secondhand.
Yeah. Books,
you know,
and records for me.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I love bookshops. I go to a lot of bookshops, and I, you know, I buy secondhand because I can afford them more. And sometimes I like the way people have written to the margins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's sort of observations, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah. And I just keep learning more and more as the crisis looms. I feel there's an urgency.
Yeah.
We're under pressure in Europe because, you know, climate migrants are amassing you know, and they're coming, and it's not something to be afraid of. I think it's something to embrace. We're going to have to take people in. This is going to happen in the United States too, you know. You're going to have to take people in and, you know, give them shelter and water and, you know, share your food with them. So the sources of everything are going to have to be shared into the future. It's something that we should encourage our public representatives to spend less on armaments and more on food and water security.
Yeah. Going back to the words thing, how people communicate using related to water, obvious question, but do you then use that in your art, those pieces that you take to relate to people who you haven't already talked to?
Well, the piece I'm talking about, that was a little video. I was in the Sahara Desert with this bunch of people, and it was so hot. I mean, you know, and the desert is moving, you know, as you probably know. It's encroaching on villages, it's moving, it's just, it's spreading. It's taking over arable land, it's terrible, it's moving fast. It's getting hotter and hotter, and so we're standing in the desert, like, very hot. It's down in the South Sahara, and so we could only do it for, like, literally 3 minutes. You know, it was too hot. But anyway, so she just says in Arabic, working some of the phrases, and I translated them. But I showed that video with desert plants that I'd, you know, the desert is covered in these plants that have just skeletonized.
Yeah.
And they're like bone. And so I took pictures of them, and then I embroidered them onto a screen. So it was a companion piece. So you stand and listen to the talk about water, look at the desert, but then you look at this screen of desert plants just skeletonized.
Yeah.
As their habitats are overtaken by the sand. So it's kind of just one another aspect of climate change, is the increasing desertification of North Africa and into Southern Europe.
Yeah. So, what about your process for deciding what projects? Not what projects you're going to take, but once you've picked a region or an organization or something, what's the process of deciding how the art you're going to create?
I look out for residencies that are in parts of the world, like last year's one, the Water Rights Residency in Santa Fe, and I was interested in New Mexico because I knew it was getting hotter down there. And then, you know, like coming to Peonia again, I saw that it was an industrial landscape that's, you know, seeing the end of industrialization and trying to move towards a more agricultural identity, and I thought that was interesting. So I've been to a lot of places that, you know, where I'm witnessing the end of mining, as it were, and or the effects or the aftermath of that industrial landscape and how that's impacted on the communities and the water bodies. And so I look for those particular types of residencies that would be interesting in terms of extending the knowledge I already have. And maybe even offering something I might have learnt from another place, you know, like, because I spend time in places like New South Wales or Canada or India or whatever, and sometimes I come across some really innovative and brilliant projects, and you just think, oh, well, that could transfer over here, or that could be usable there. So
yeah,
I like to share knowledge as well.
Yeah.
And that's what socially engaged art is, really, at the fundamental level. A lot of it's to do with knowledge sharing and knowledge co-production with communities, you know, and problem solving. You know, identifying a problem and then trying to solve it some way as a group, you know.
How do you come to the decision to say, I'm going to make a banner, or I'm going to do performance, or I'm going to suggest murals? Like, how do you decide the format? I'm missing a word that I'm just not thinking of, but...
Yeah. Well, I think about what would be applicable best in that area. So here, for example, I thought, there seems to be a lack of education or ability to talk about it or willingness to talk about it. It's, you know, about, I did go to a workshop the other day, grey water reuse and rainwater harvesting, and some of the people who were attending, you know, were ranchers, and they were interested in, you know, finding out about these things, but they were unaware that the law was passed 2 years ago, the rainwater harvesting law, and they were unaware of their rights within that. And, you know, and it does seem that, you know, there could be better education or better knowledge sharing here about those kind of things, you know. There is a resolution 86, which is grey water reuse. It's been passed in Colorado State, but it's up to each county to adopt it. And there seems to be very little knowledge out there about it at all. Mm. Nobody's pushing their public representatives to adopt it. So there are a few things that I felt, you know, I could contribute to spreading that knowledge within the community. And hopefully that'll impact further on down the line into helping build some climate resilience into the future. If they start now, it might help. You know, when the crisis comes, they might have already changed their practices to encompass less water.
Yeah.
And better use of water as it is, you know. Mm. So how I came to the form, I thought, okay, education. The banners are educational. They're sort of protest counter-monuments. They function as counter-monuments when they're carried through a street. They're non-permanent and not threatening. Mm-hmm. But they use a visual language of a banner being carried. It does have a language of protest, or a language of pay attention, or a language of knowledge distribution. You know, so it functions in a number of different ways. So I think I haven't made that many banners, but I think I'm going to make more into the future. I think they are kind of useful. Mm-hmm. And then if they're gifted, in this case, gifted to the high school, but if they're gifted to an organisation who will use them and bring them out, and knowledge will eventually filter through, I think.
Mm-hmm. They're beautiful too.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of work goes into them. And I hope that some of the conversation that happens around, maybe in the arts class in the school, is, you know, women's work. You know, the amount of hours, I didn't count the hours that went into that, but a lot of hours, you know. So I like the idea of work and pay gets discussed, the production of artworks, production of artefacts, and how artefacts are made and what they're for and what uses they're put to, whether it's an art piece or whether it's a trade union banner, or whether it's, you know, the American flag, famously sewn by a woman, you know. Mm-hmm. So It's this idea of looking at the broader use of imagery in culture.
Yeah.
Murals, again, is information sharing and encouraging people to use the democratic system that they belong to be more active citizens. Like, active citizens can do a lot. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of exercising your right to vote every now and again. You really should be actively engaged in your own democracy, you know.
And especially if you band together.
If you band together, you can do an awful lot. And and I think, you know, the murals are kind of a call to action a little bit in a very subtle way. But, you know, I'd like, if they do get passed by the town council to go up, you know, I'd like Resolution 86 to be put up there, you know, and Paeonia harvests water up there, and maybe the law printed on the wall as well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's House Bill something. I have it written down somewhere, but yeah. Put that up, and then people can look up the law and engage with it. So a lot gets passed, I think, in legal terms, and then not really enacted because people don't know about it.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And that's a job for journalism as well, isn't it? You know.
Mm-hmm.
Although I did hear, I was listening to the radio, Carbondale, and there was a lot of talk about water conservation on the radio, KVNF.
KVNF, that's right here.
Yeah. But there's another chapter down in Carbondale.
Mm.
Or Montrose.
Mm.
Yeah, they were talking a lot about that. But it's like as if maybe people don't listen to the radio much here.
Yeah, maybe.
Not sure.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Anyone listens to the radio as, you know, I guess if you're in a car, but the people aren't really in their cars that much here.
No. Like, yeah. So I use whatever form of art making I deem appropriate to the conditions I find myself in, you know. Or in the location.
Before I ask you the three questions I ask everyone,
mm-hmm.
Selfish question. You mentioned books on climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one that comes to mind that I should read?
Well, there's one I can't remember. I will send you the book.
Okay.
But it's written by a climate scientist in Canada.
Mm.
He has documented, his name has just gone out of my head, I'm sorry, but I will. He's written this book. He's brought together all the climate science data from 1960s up for a whole of North America. So he's taken data from all the different research centres around North America, and he's collated it into one book.
Oh.
And basically the form of this book is to, he wants to use it as a tool to persuade politicians to really take this seriously. And, you know, he's got photographs and graphs, but there's photographs of glaciers, what they looked like in 1960 and what they look like today.
Mm.
So I think it was written in 2015, the book.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's quite startling. And there's a lot of kind of climate science within it, but he has actually made it readable for the general public because it's aimed at politicians.
Yeah.
But he doesn't hold any punches, and he talks about how urgent this is now, and he talks about how the permaculture, nobody ever thought permafrost would ever melt.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, back in the day, in the 50s, a lot of dumping of, you know, crude oil and stuff was dumped on permafrost up in North Canada. And he talks about if this starts to melt, it's going to go into rivers and lakes and reservoirs, and this is going to be a huge environmental crisis. And he's saying it needs to be a clean up now. And, you know, so he's very intelligent and useful book to read and easy to read.
So the three questions I ask everyone, what does the word process mean to you?
Process for me is the way that I process the information I have and how I think about it. I suppose emotionally and intellectually, and then how I process that into artworks. Mm-hmm. So for me, the process is gathering information and research, filtering it through a number of processes in my experience and head, and then thinking about the aesthetics of an artwork. Because for me, obviously, it's very important that there's an aesthetic that I can attribute to within the artwork. And that can be very loaded, because there's processes of thought that have gone into it, and you have to be very careful that you're not appropriating someone else's culture, and that can be even, you have to be very careful about appropriation.
Yeah.
Appropriation of other people's work, other people's cultures, other people's traditions, other people's, you know. So it, you know, the process of thinking aesthetically, there's a lot of decision making that goes into that. So I suppose process and decision making are very interchangeable for me as concepts. Because we're constantly processing information in our head, but that makes us make particular decisions about our lifestyles, about like how we live, what we do, where we go, what to eat. You know, all these are processes that have a process of ways of thinking.
Mm.
And so for me, as I streamline them down into art making, they've gone through a number of interesting process mutations, I suppose.
Yeah, like filters almost?
Yeah, I suppose you could say filters, yeah, because if you think, okay, even if I decide I'm going to make a banner, like what language am I going to use, what's the words, what colours will I use? You know, now in this case it was easy, peonia colours, I decided. But the colours are related to the cherries, the red of the cherry, and etc. That was an easy process, really, in those decisions. But then, of course, then you get down to the actual process of making it. So once you've made the decisions and the process of thinking through to decision making, and then the making is a process too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think process is can be subdivided again through different channels, whether it's intellectual, emotional, physical. Physical making of something is a process because it transforms a material from one state to another.
Right.
You know, so it is a process of change. Yeah. So there's a transformation in the process of making.
Was it you who was like, when I hear process, I think of processed food? Was that you?
Someone here
in Peonia said that to me recently. That's funny.
Well, yeah, it does go through a lot of processes to get to the, you know.
How do you avoid cultural appropriation? With there being, like, I feel like that'd be relatively easy within the culture you're operating in for that project, but on a greater scale, so much out there, it's so hard to know.
Well, you have to be very aware of the visual language that you're using.
Mm.
And so it was funny because when I did the performance in Kochiti Dam with Courtney's Shinnecock Nation, First Nations identity, that's her identity and her background. And so she was worried about wearing a Victorian veil and what that meant to her. Mm. You know, and we talked a long time. We had to go through a real process of talk about, you know, the Industrial Revolution and how, you know, how America's in, you know, how that's affected all of us, you know. So it started a whole interesting conversation, but I chose to use black and white, like the white on the black, like I did with this veil as well. So when we did the designs for the hydrological cycle, we had to be very careful that we didn't borrow Japanese, you know, or make it look too New Zealand-like, or, you know. But as artists, we're constantly looking at things in that way, you know, we're constantly, you know, trying to make it yours and being aware of, you know, you can use anything from your own culture, but you've got to be very, aware of other people's culture. I would never have used, like, for example, we used deer hide for the ropes. We made rope out of deer hide to carry the pots.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I would not have done that if it had not been Courtney. And, you know, Courtney made the rope, and so it was from her tradition. Right. But I would not have done that myself. If I had just a European walking alone, I would not have used that particular visual language and material, you know. But it was okay for her too, so we could do it together. But, you know, we had to be very cognizant of that, you know.
Yeah.
So cultural appropriation can sneak up. If you're not paying attention, it can sneak up and bite you on the bum. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful and really analyse everything that you make and every image that you use and even the colours combinations that you put together.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to be aware of that.
Yeah.
And we're trained to do that,
mm.
trained to see it. I think people can be very sloppy, though. And I've seen, you know, I'm sure you have yourself, you know, you've
yeah.
seen artworks.
Oh, tone deaf.
You know,
yeah,
and it sticks out a mile, really,
mm-hmm.
you know, so disrespectful,
yeah.
you know, and I don't want mm-hmm. to ever be disrespectful, because I want artworks to, like, communicate something, and I don't want to ever annoy anyone or, like, piss anyone off.
You're starting a conversation, you're not trying to disrupt, would you say that's accurate, or?
Yeah, well, disruption is a useful tool, yeah. If people are stuck in patterns of thinking, sometimes a disruptive image or something can switch that thinking, you
mm-hmm.
know, or bring it down a new path.
Yeah.
And that can be the role of an artwork, is to start that sort of change,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that can be very useful. But, I mean, some artists do. I just personally don't want to offend people. Some people use it as a tactic, you know, to be deeply offensive
yeah.
as a way of jolting somebody, you know, jolting the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Or confronting them, you know. I personally don't feel comfortable doing that, but I can see the value of it. It's not my methodology.
Yeah. If someone had a cause that they cared about or felt that it was important to bring to light and wanted to get into socially engaged art, whether or not they're an artist,
mm-hmm.
what advice would you have for them?
Well, I think if people are really, really exercised by, you know, there's always groups out there who are willing to take you on, you know,
yeah.
Or to work with. In the voluntary sector, there's so many different sort of like-minded groups out there, you know, who on a particular issue. I think join and get active with a community of like-minded people. Get out and protest, you know, use whatever methods. I mean, I kind of, walking has always been part of my life, you know, walking in the landscape. But it's now turned into a political tool. And I see a lot of people are doing, you know, they do runs, they do walks. I was very inspired by a group in Canada, which of Indigenous people who got together to protest about the tar sands.
Mm-hmm.
And they're called Idle No More. And it's like it's a cross transgenerational, transcultural Indigenous group.
Mm-hmm.
So they have links with North American tribes. They have links with Maoris in New Zealand. You know, Aboriginals in Australia, but they do a lot of walking, and they walk around poisoned lakes. It's part redemption, it's part political action, it's part community healing,
mm.
you know.
Mm.
They know they can't heal the lake, but walking around it just, you know, helps people come to terms with it,
mm.
you know. So walking is a very good tool. So I think anyone who's getting involved in socially engaged practice, you know, look at the methodologies of different groups and how they, you know. I mean, you've got your out-and-out protests, you've got your sit-ins, you've got your Occupy movement, you know. But get involved and get transmitting these political ideas. Get active. I think it's time that people got really active, and I think there's a great power in gathering, you know, gathering together
mm.
in groups. I'm not so keen on Facebook groups and, you know,
yeah.
it's pouring out their outrage on Facebook. I don't think that. I think the actual getting together with human beings in one room, you know, or on a street is much more powerful.
Yeah.
And is more, you know, it says more of a statement. I think there really should be an awful
yeah,
lot more of that.
To get out their door and take the time and
yeah, spend
like
a whole day.
Hiding behind this
thing. Yeah, and you know, you can do it in 5 minutes, sign your
yeah.
petition, but like get out there, you know, spend a day, you know, shouting through a megaphone, you know. Get dirty, get
yeah.
down and dirty. I think it's very important. There was a time when there was a lot of this, and it seemed to die off. You know, there was anti-war rallies
yeah.
and marches. You know, if you think of the 60s.
I think people, the thing is, I won't say it failed, but I think there's so many holes
mm.
in the movements of the 60s that people, they're not taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Even today. And I think that's one of the reasons why it kind of fizzled.
Mm. But I think that I think if you look back into history, though, they might have not achieved all the goals that they set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the civil rights marches did a lot,
yeah.
You know, and they did a lot in Ireland. You know, there were civil rights marches in Ireland when, you know, Catholics didn't have the vote, mm-hmm. You know, like Protestants, you know, only a householder could vote. It was sheer discrimination against, you know, the Catholics. And, you know, they didn't have one man, one vote. And, you know, I think there were successes in civil rights movements. It just didn't achieve everything, but they did achieve huge social change.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen as fast as we might have liked, but it happened.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. I think we have to look, you know, half glass full, not half glass empty, back at some of these things. Because social legislation did happen a lot out of these movements. And, okay, not everything, but, you know, good things did come out of them. And, you know, that wouldn't have happened otherwise. Yeah, women getting the vote back in the day, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it took women running under buses and throwing themselves off buildings practically to make that happen. But they got the vote eventually, it happened.
Yeah.
So human agency has been very successful through the centuries, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So we mustn't just sort of give up and go, oh, it's got too big, I can't do anything about it. You know, it's not helpful.
Yeah.
I think we can bring about great change. And we just need to keep it in the public eye. And if people have lost the attention span, that's something that, you know, we really do need to address. You know, attention span has got pathetically poor.
It's so bad.
Yeah. And I mean, that's not good enough. Maybe it's back to education.
And it also comes back to consumption. Like, our attention span's limited because we consume so much shit.
Yeah. It's like, where's the next thing? It just seems, I don't know. Yeah. I think a lot of these things need to be contested. But I have great faith in the youth. I've met some really engaged young people who are politically engaged, socially engaged. And I just think, thank God, mm-hmm. You know. They're out there and they're working hard for civil society. So it's great. And, you know, I'm much more optimistic than most.
Yeah.
I do sometimes have my moments of depression and I think, oh my God, there's no hope. But, you know. I think we have to go down fighting at least. I'm not going to give up.
Yeah.
Don't think we should give up.
No.
Go away.
No,
quietly.
Yeah, if we give up, what happens then?
Yeah, exactly. So go down fighting at least.
Yeah. Last question. What is something you're excited about today?
I am very excited. You mean personally or in general?
Anything.
Yeah. I'm very excited my friend Carol's coming this evening. I'm very excited about spending the next few days in Paonia and really having a holiday. Mm-hmm. I'm not really doing terribly much.
You deserve it.
A few little things that I have to do to clean up and tidy up, but I am excited about that. I'm excited about delivering the banner to the school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm also excited about going home. But it's been great being here. I've met lots of amazing people, yourself included. And it's been, you know, it's been one of those rich experiences of life.
Yeah.
You know, it's what keeps me ticking. Because I get bored very easily.
Yeah, no, me too.
So I have to pay attention to not getting bored. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no excuse for boredom, you know. So but I do need lots of stimulation. That's why I do these projects, these long projects in different countries or, you know, away from home, is because they really are very intensely focused on what you're doing, and there's no time to be getting too caught up in your own life, you know, your own thing. So it's very good that way.
Yeah.
You know, you can get delve deep in. So I love doing them, but they are exhausting.
Yeah.
And going home will be nice.
Yeah. Would you ever want to make your home somewhere else, or is that home?
I flirted with the idea of moving somewhere else.
Yeah.
I don't know. I love going away, but I love going home. I love going back to my, you know, the sort of familiarity of place that I know very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's something lovely, I have to say, I sound like Bord Fáilte for Ireland, but there's something lovely about going back to Ireland because it's relatively clean. Mm. You know, the air's clean, the water's clean. You know, it's one of the cleaner countries, to be fair.
Yeah.
Culturally, it's very friendly and welcoming, and you know, you get a great welcome home. And it's, I don't know, I just feel at ease there. So I always like going back. It seems less complicated than other places.
Yeah.
In terms of political, like it feels safer.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like it's safe. I don't always agree with government and policy making, and but it's sort of centrist, and it's a safe pair of hands, kind of, you know. I don't feel we're in any immediate threat. Like, I'd say Americans feel that they're in an immediate threat with the government they have now.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible place to be for them, you know. And it must be very scary and very unsettling.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
It is.
And, you know, and I really feel for you. I think I feel desperately upset for the state of things and the state of the nation as it is. And I hope it'll improve.
Yeah.
And I do like going back to Ireland because it does feel safe. It feels safe environmentally and it feels safe politically.
Yeah.
Long may it continue.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you, Anna.